This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Professor Alexander McMillan from the Department of Preventive and Social Medicine, who talks and teaches about public health, but also environmental health. Would that be correct? Welcome to Community or Chaos.
Thanks, Marvin. Kia ora.
You can podcast this by going to oarfm.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to Community or Chaos. Briefly, what is public health?
Public health is really all about thinking at a community and population level and thinking and focusing on the prevention of disease and illness and how we support healthy lives rather than having to deal with illness and disease when it happens to individuals. And a lot of that lies outside people's individual control. Some of it comes down to the choices we might make in our lives, but a lot of it happens well outside individual control. And if you think about where health starts in healthy homes and healthy neighborhoods, healthy places to work, and environments that are healthy, including fresh water and clean air and a safe climate. And those things are outside of people's individual control, and that means that we need to focus on those building blocks of health, which we also know are often unfairly distributed and behind a whole lot of the health inequalities that we see.
Haven't some of the greatest life-saving events happened? Not so much in surgery, though that's important, or even doctors, but by public health. For instance, getting clean water in Great Britain.
Yeah, so a lot of the public health interventions over history have been the events that have been behind really major improvements in population
and
health.
And they save millions of lives sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Things like vaccinations, sanitation, clean water, dealing with industrial air pollution, these things are they can save millions of lives, as you say.
We've forgotten how to think collectively. I mean, most public health is about collective decisions that society, often through government, make. And we, more and more in the last 50 years, think individually. I remember the phrase, do your own thing, and at the time I didn't like it. And the more I learned, the less I liked that phrase. It seems to me that in some ways, one of the problems with the economic system and society is greed. And that some ways greed is enhanced by our, maybe this started with the Enlightenment in some ways, but the idea that the individual is the optimum, that self autonomous individuals, the thing we should really aim for more than anything. And I wonder if that's been a mistake.
Well, from a public health point of view, if we talk about those building blocks of health, that takes the collective efforts of society to address. That takes public policy. It takes community efforts to change. And what we have seen, as you say, over the last few centuries is the shift towards an economics of individualism, and that's come with a similar shift in health and in medicine away from community and societal action on collective health issues that are outside of people's control to a shift towards framing health problems as individual responsibility and a kind of an approach to health that puts the responsibility on individuals to be healthy, when we know that many of the things that are blocking people from being healthy are at a structural and societal level, and individuals can't make headway.
Doesn't that also affect our mental health? I mean, I suspect one of the problems with the country I lived in 60 years ago is their extreme individualism and consumerism. I'm thinking of America.
Well, we know that loneliness is an issue, is a mental health issue, a major mental health issue, and that social connection and community are important underpinnings of mental well-being, that's for sure. And that some of the effects of our approach to environmental health are also having a big negative impact on people's mental health. And I'm thinking about climate change in particular.
How does environmental health fit into public health? I think we've just been talking about this to some extent.
We think about the building blocks of health as being in two kind of areas. We think about the social building blocks of health, things like the way we set up our social systems, things like welfare, things like the kind of institutions and rules and politics and economic system. And then we think about the environmental building blocks of health, and they're really critical and foundational to health, well-being, and even human survival. So things like having clean water to drink, and therefore managing our fresh water systems so that they're not polluted. Things like clean air to breathe, which means, again, managing our economic and social systems so that the air is not polluted. And things like a safe climate, safe housing, healthy housing, urban environments that don't kill us, that aren't dangerous to walk around, for example. All of these things are incredibly important building blocks of health at a population level, and of health equity as well.
What do you think about when governments and society puts growth before the environment and before health?
Well, I think that there's a deeper problem with an economic model that puts profits before people. And I think that we're really seeing that in legislation happening at the moment, including changes to our environmental protection legislation, which is really what we would say is some of the most important public health legislation. So we would see legislation like the Resource Management Act, which is our environmental legislation, as being really a critical piece of legislation to protect people's health from pollution. And so when we put economic growth and profits before people's health, then we lose sight of the things that really improve people's quality of life and allow for thriving communities. And we also know that, so we know in terms of if we wanted to focus on prosperity and thriving communities, that healthy communities are thriving communities. So when people are well, they're more able to take part in meaningful activities that include voluntary and paid work, education, social activities, and contribute to local economies and social well-being. So that kind of economic well-being is certainly part of well-being, quality of life, but it's just one part.
We live in and with an environment. So isn't the environment and the health of the environment at least as important as economic growth?
It's more fundamental. We can't have economic well-being and human well-being without protecting and ensuring the health of ecosystems upon which we depend.
Doesn't the environment have value in itself?
Yes, absolutely.
I know that's not a scientific question.
And I think this is an issue for public health, in that if we put humans at the center of things, and human health and well-being at the center of things, we can tend to forget that nature and the more than human have their own rights and value, beside their value to and contribution to human health, well-being, and survival. So we need to pay attention not just to centering human health and well-being, but also to thinking about things like multi-species justice.
I sometimes think that it's wrong to say that the measure of all things is humankind. I know it's been the way liberal ideology and even the Enlightenment have seen things for a long time, but I wonder about that. Might even be wrong or even dangerous to think that humankind is the ultimate measurement, the measurement of all things.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's happened in a Western exploitative approach to nature and to other peoples is to create a hierarchy of being, as you say, from the Enlightenment, which was really a justification for exploitation, colonial exploitation in particular, but exploitation of the environment as well. That shift that we need to make in to address the multiple planetary crises that we're facing, things like climate change and biodiversity collapse, which are real threats to population health, they require a mindset shift to put humans back in their place, if you like, in an interconnected ecological web of being that doesn't have a hierarchy necessarily. And so those we need to come back to a kind of original instruction or ancestral understanding that's not that understands interrelationships.
It seems to me that science and values are two different things. That science is important, and that probably the best way we have of measuring the physical world, or with the idea that science can be falsified, but that we also have other ways of knowing, as well as scientific knowing. And it doesn't mean that if, for instance, I have a gut feeling that I don't like vaccination. It doesn't mean I can say the science is wrong. So I think it's complicated. But we do, for instance, Hannah Enright, who wrote about totalitarianism, a Jewish intellectual who actually, I don't know if this is beside the point or not, opposed to Israel becoming a state, even though she'd helped people arrive there to escape death. But she said that human beings, if we're whole and pay attention, we know that certain things are wrong, that we can know. And we should pay attention and be present when we're making decisions. And if we decide to go along with evil, it's hard to turn back.
There really is a, I think it's difficult when we glorify science as being somehow values neutral or separate from a discussion about values or about morals, because scientists are people, and the questions that they ask, the way that they go about collecting data and the way they go about interpreting those data and finding meaning from them, are influenced by their own views of how the world works and what knowledge is.
That's true.
And so I think we need to understand that science is an incredibly useful tool for us and an important source of knowledge. But there are multiple ways of knowing and being, as you say, and that science isn't somehow separately divorced from values, from the values of the people who are doing the science in particular. And the more we make those values explicit, the more we can have trust actually in the science, and put it in the context of a variety of ways of knowing and being, and make good decisions, including about the things that we're talking about, these environmental and planetary underpinnings of public health.
When it comes to public health, are there public health issues that we can deal with and improve on the local level?
Yeah, so often when people think about health, they think about the healthcare system. They think about hospitals and GP offices, GP clinics, and Te Whatu Ora, Health New Zealand. And these things we could really reframe as the illness care system. And think about where public health lies is very much in outside of that system. And there are really areas of public health that can be affected and improved by local actions and changes. So there's a lot that lies at least under the partial control of our elected representatives in local government. So we interact with city and regional councils every day, not just when we put our bins out or flush the toilet, but also when we open our taps and expect clean drinking water. Each time we take a breath and expect that the air is clean enough not to make us sick, or when we try and get fairly from A to B safely and fairly, even if we can't drive or can't afford to put petrol in the car. Every time we go for a calming and happiness-giving walk in one of our parks or try and walk to school along one of our footpaths, we're interacting with the role of city and regional councils in our everyday lives. And so what councils do is critical for building those building blocks that I talked about for healthy lives. And each investment we make collectively in these elements of our living environment prevents illness and takes pressures off our health system that we can measure and value and count. So when counsellors march in support of a new hospital with an adequate number of beds and adequate services, with signs that say you save, we pay, we should be asking them in return what actions they're taking to save hospital beds, to take the pressure off our overstretched emergency department, which has been in the news in the last few days, to shorten surgical waiting lists by turning the tap off of injury and disease through preventive action at a local level. And if I can give some examples of that, some really specific examples of that, areas like tackling the more than 600 regional hospitalizations from air pollution by supporting healthy, energy-efficient homes that can be warmed cleanly without burning fossil fuels and burning trees, by providing alternatives to driving everywhere, and also the avoiding the deaths and serious injuries from road traffic injuries. So we've got really high rates of road traffic crashes compared with other wealthy countries and even other cities in New Zealand. And meanwhile, cities like Helsinki are achieving zero. They have achieved this year zero road traffic deaths through a mixture of slowing speeds, shifting the design of streets to make it easier to get around by walking, wheelchair, bus. These are really effective ways of taking the pressure off our health system and also making for a high quality of life in our cities.
Isn't it quite important that we actually support public transport and try to make it have enough variety so everybody can benefit from it?
Public transport is a really important public good and a really important piece of the puzzle for how we address climate change in particular.
Some of the things the council haven't done, they haven't done because they feel like they can't afford it because they only have one way of collecting money, and that's rates. For instance, in the past, water was partially paid for by the central government, and now it's paid for totally by the ratepayers and local government. And we don't have the attitude that we have toward wealth and money includes the idea that, well, if I can get away without paying taxes or I can have lower taxes, that's good, even though it may be bad for the community. We don't see that it might be bad for the community, and we don't want to see that, actually. But also, we know that taxes and so on are collected unfairly, that the wealthy pay less, and those who can least afford it pay more. Is that a health issue?
I think tax is a core public health issue, and it's a core environmental health issue. If I go back to where we started with what public health is and what it requires the willingness to act collectively as a society, to act on the building blocks of health and to ensure that those building blocks are fairly distributed, whether it's by income, by ethnicity, by gender, between generations, and we could extend that to between species.
Is living wage a health issue?
I think you started to talk about this issue of revenue and the ability to invest, and I think there's a crisis of revenue and an ability to invest in the building blocks of health at central and local government in New Zealand. And we've seen that manifest in the state of our publicly funded health service, the state of our local hospital, the state of our water infrastructure, and the declining state of our environment. And so as citizens and communities, we need to decide whether we're willing to invest in the things that we say that we want, and that includes very high quality public services. It includes a sustainable environments and healthy environments, whether we're willing to invest in a fair way in the building blocks of health for everybody. And the council can't invest in these important things without, as you say, fair contributions to invest. And that might mean we need to think about, can we have the things that we want, high quality of life, high quality public services, safe and healthy building blocks of health like housing and transport, whilst also wanting lower rates? Because it's very difficult to have both, especially when central government is not willing to invest. And nationally, we have some of the lowest levels of income tax in amongst high-income countries around the world. We're really near the bottom of in terms of the percentage of income tax that we pay. And so we can't continue to divest in those collective pools of investment for the building blocks of health and expect to have high quality of life, to have good, fair public services.
When I think of New Zealand and the arguments I've heard for having low taxes, low wages, and basically depending on the market for everything, including electricity, I think of Scandinavia, but I think specifically of Finland. Why do I think of Finland? I think of Finland because they have the best education system in the world, and it's free. They have a good health system, and their resources are not profoundly huge. They have their physical resources are forests, trees, and lakes. They don't have oil like Norway. They didn't start out with iron ore or heavy industry like Sweden. They didn't have any more resources than we had. Perhaps the only advantage they had that we don't have was geographic. But even that, I mean, they had to worry about a neighbor who had colonized them a number of times. Yet they built a welfare state. They built a free education system. That was a political choice, and they made it work. But they believed they could do that. And you have to make, somehow society has to make a decision, what kind of society do we want? And we're unwilling to make that decision, so we leave it to the powers that be. We leave it to the people that are already powerful and wealthy to make that decision. Unless the people make a decision, we'll never change.
I mean, collectively as a society, we do need to make those decisions, and and citizens and communities do have the power to do that, including at election time. We've got the local body elections coming up. New Zealand, you know, you're talking about Scandinavian countries like Finland. New Zealand has historically invested in these social building blocks of health, in trying to have fair and affordable housing, in investing in public services like our public healthcare system, which has been a really amazing public good. And so we can decide to do that again if we choose to. And we've got this opportunity coming up with the local body elections to choose candidates who are willing to invest in those building blocks of health.
When we vote for people who say we're going to lower rates, we're making a choice, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We're making a choice. We can't have it both ways. We can't. I think we need to decide collectively whether we want lower rates and have to deal with the consequences of that, the fallouts of that in terms of crumbling infrastructure, poor public services, unfair distribution of the building blocks of health, and poor regulation of pollution and poor investment in things like water infrastructure.
We're in some ways Dunedin luckier than some, because we actually started investing in our water system about 7 years ago, about 3 or 4 years before most other regions were doing that. Is the purity of the water in our lakes and rivers, the health of our lakes, is that important to public health and to mental health?
It's important in so many ways. Fresh water has a huge number of connections to health and well-being, not just by being the source of safe drinking water. We can, for example, we can chlorinate our way out of some problems of dirty water, but not others. We can't chlorinate our way out of nitrogen pollution, for example. But there are a whole lot of other connections between fresh water and health that include being able to gather and harvest mahinga kai, traditional sources of wild food, safely. Spiritual connections and cultural connections with fresh water. The importance of fresh water for the web of life upon which we depend, in terms of those, the more than human, those other species, things like fish and birds and trees and insects upon which we depend. So there are many connections between fresh water and health, and that makes fresh water management, the quality of our rivers and lakes, really important public health issues.
Isn't it important to our society in a way that there are places wherever you live where you can go down to the beach and you can take a small amount of shellfish, mussels, other tapia, and know it's safe and it's part of, and for many people it's part of their tradition? Isn't that an important thing to keep alive?
It's not just important for everybody's health and well-being to be able to have that that connection to nature and that interrelationship that you're talking about, but it's also a right.
Okay.
It's also a right for Māori, and it's built into Te Tiriti or Waitangi that they would have those taonga protected.
And doesn't that, in a way, protect all of society?
Absolutely, those protection of those Te Tiriti rights is beneficial for everybody.
How do we manage, how do we deal with climate change? Where are we going there?
Climate change is one symptom of a broader crisis of our relationship with nature. And putting other things in that picture, we have issues with biodiversity loss, in other words, extinction of species, of other species. We have issues with fresh water and fresh water management. We have problems with land use change. And we have problems with flows of things like nitrogen and phosphorus. And we also have this kind of big unknown of chemical pollution as well. So these are all part of a picture of what we might call a planetary polycrisis. Climate change itself, as one symptom of that deeper crisis of relationality with nature, is the biggest public health issue facing us globally, and a really important public health issue in New Zealand and locally. If we think about what's happening locally with flooding and sea level rise, for example, we can see that flowing through into people's health and well-being through damp and mouldy housing, through the stress and worry about future flooding, through the stress and worry of houses being damaged. So we know that climate change is a major public health issue, but we also know now that well-designed action to reduce climate pollution can come with tangible, measurable, short-term benefits for health and fairness that people can experience. And that includes across all the sectors of society that we need to transform in response to climate change, whether it's our housing, whether it's our sources of energy, whether it's our food system and agriculture, whether it's transport.
What do you think when government leaders say that New Zealand's so small, it doesn't matter if we try to mitigate climate change, that it doesn't matter to the world? Isn't that doing something? Isn't that devaluing New Zealand's values and devaluing New Zealand? Don't we have an ethical obligation? It doesn't matter how small we are.
Firstly, all countries have a responsibility to, under the Paris Agreement, to get to net zero emissions. And we've committed to doing that along with almost all the other countries in the world. And New Zealand has achieved wealth and high quality of life on the back of our climate pollution so far. So we're a high income country with a high level of capacity to transform and reduce our climate pollution and play our part globally. Secondly, New Zealand, our per capita emissions, so we have a small population, we're a small country. If you add up all the small countries, they play a major part collectively. Our per capita emissions, on the other hand, our per person emissions, are very high globally. We sit in the top 10 generally of per person emissions. And that gives us extra responsibility to address our collective climate pollution in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Addressing our climate pollution, though, is also an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity to shift from harmful and unhealthy modes of being and doing to healthier, happiness-generating and economic well-being generating ways of doing and being across those sectors, as I've talked about.
If we rebalanced agriculture and the government not only by requirement but by helping agriculture diversify, wouldn't we not only help with mitigation of climate change, but also wouldn't we have cleaner water?
there are lots of reasons to transform our food production system in particular. The agriculture contributes at the moment slightly more than half of all of our climate pollution. And so we do need to address our agricultural emissions. And we can either do that by waiting for technological new technologies that continue with how we currently produce food and our dominant, the dominant kind of ways of producing food. That might help to address climate change, but as you say, it wouldn't help to address the other major issues that we have with that dominant way of doing agriculture that we have at the moment, and that includes freshwater pollution, and it includes land use change, it includes erosion. What we saw happen with the damage that we saw that happened with Cyclone Gabriel wasn't just about the fierceness of a weather event contributed to by climate change. It was also about land use choices and land use governance, including livestock agriculture as well as forestry. So there are many co-benefits of transforming our food production system. The other reason that we need to think about our food system and our agricultural production systems is about resilience of our food system to shocks, including climate shocks, but also including conflict. And so what we're seeing right now is rising food prices and intermittent scarcity of some food products in our supermarkets. And we saw that especially after Cyclone Gabriel, where supermarket shelves were empty of things like kumara and other vegetable staples and fruit staples as a result of that cyclone. And so we need to ensure that our food system is resilient to climate change as well as reducing our agricultural climate pollution. And that means reshaping towards, as you say, diversity, future thinking about what grows where, what's the most efficient use of land to feed our population most healthily. How do we contribute regionally to our food resilience and food and healthy food systems, including in the Pacific, who are facing real problems with food resilience as a result of climate change?
Well, I know, for instance, in Japan, they try to have enough rice so that even if they can't import it, people can have rice.
Yeah, that's right.
It seems to me that we need to look at, when we look at resilience, it should include food, but also that resilience in agriculture and our economy, that we should look at how we can support diversification so that we're not dependent on one thing. I mean, it bothers me that we send logs to China just as logs, and that because of the free market control of electricity and the fact that generation electricity has been privatized, many of the people who were actually trying to do something with logs, many timber mills and so on in the North Island have to close. So it's all connected, isn't it?
I think the food system piece, which is critical for health, when we think about the food system in Aotearoa, New Zealand, our food production system, We mostly are eating food that is produced in New Zealand, but we import a number of major staples. which is a source of risk in terms of shocks.
We used to grow a lot of our own wheat, I understand.
There's certainly, if you look at even 60 years ago in Otago, in our region, there was a lot more growth of grains and legumes to feed people. And there's been an incredibly marked shift towards a focus on dairy farming and on producing milk and milk products for export.
That comes partly from agricultural decisions in Fonterra, but it also comes from the decisions that we made to focus we not only have a mono culture, agricultural culture, but we also we've made decisions that we only produce a very few things for New Zealand for trade. And I wonder if that wasn't a mistake. That if you make all your income from selling milk powder to China, how do you change that? Then it becomes quite difficult to build in the variety that you need to diversify.
New Zealand certainly made some choices about to open up our agricultural system to the international markets, and became one of the countries with the least protections of our national agricultural system, overt protections at least, the least subsidies, the least import tariffs. And that's had some positives, and it's had some negatives. It's allowed us to sell our agricultural products on the international market and contribute that to our economic well-being. On the other hand, it's come with some unintended negative consequences in terms of the concentration for instance, as you say, dairy farming, and the consequences of that on things like fresh water, and also on national food prices and health through food insecurity and food prices. So we do need to reorient our food production system to address these, not just the environmental health issues, but the food security, food price, food system resilience issues that are facing us. And that includes food system injustices. For example, the fact that 1 in 5 New Zealand children live with food insecurity and food poverty. So they're not getting a decent meal on the table each day. They're going to school without having eaten breakfast. These are also major public health issues.
That would be one of the arguments why the school lunch program that we had was a good thing. I mean, it's sad when people have to depend on school lunches for their main healthy food because they can't afford to go into the supermarket and buy enough food for family. But if you have that situation, having a good school lunch program, it seems to me, is not only valuable, but ethically necessary.
These programs are really critical for investing in children's health in a fair way. We need to address the root causes of child poverty and child food insecurity. That includes food prices. But in the meantime, countries that fairly invest in child health and well-being include universal school lunches as a core part of that, in a way that that avoids the stigma of only providing food, only providing school lunches to in low-income schools or to low-income children. And it also invests in all children in a way that reaps benefits in the long term in terms of child well-being leading to adult well-being, leading to ability to participate.
And they wouldn't just measure it by how much it costs, would they? Or what's the cheapest way to do it? And should we have a... does it make sense to move school lunches from one particular part of the country to all the rest of the country? The same with hospital food.
I think this takes us back to some of what we were talking about with addressing climate change. When we take a single issue focus, we might be very narrow in our thinking about responses. But if we approach things like school lunches, like climate change, in a holistic way, then we can consider a range of broad benefits. For example, to local economies, to local food production, to cultural well-being, as well as to child well-being in the case of school lunches, to environmental well-being. And when we do that, rather than just thinking about the cost, we put that cost against on the ledger with the broad range of benefits and try to measure and consider those benefits. And when we do that, we find that these interventions are incredibly cost effective. And we can extend that not just from the example of school lunches, but to the kinds of investments that we've already been talking about that can be made at local government level. So things like investments in public transport, investments in walking and biking. When we look at the broad costs and benefits of those kinds of investments, what we find is that they come with tens of dollars of benefits in both savings for the health system, in benefits to health and well-being, in benefits to fairness and justice, and social well-being.
Should our public hospital system remain public, or should we follow the American example of private insurance and private hospitals?
There's a whole hour of conversation we could have about that, and people who are much better qualified to have that conversation with you. But we've really benefited from having a mostly publicly funded health system. We do have part payments for general practice, for primary care, but we've certainly benefited in terms of it being cost effective and effective. And from a public health perspective, that is worth protecting.
Does it worry you when people assume that private hospitals and private care is more efficient and better, and they invest taxpayers' money in that direction?
I think concern about the future is well placed, and I think hope and determination are important. And I don't mean the kind of hope that is sitting passively and expecting that things will be okay. I mean the kind of hope that is a determination to get out of bed and take collective action, because that's what's going to be needed. And I think that there are a lot of people who have that sense of determination towards action. And I think we have a better understanding of what the barriers are.
Thanks a lot for coming on board. I really appreciated talking with you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Marvin, for having me. Kia ora.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.